Yes. So they're right here. Okay.
Okay, so my first question is, what is your role here in the Title IX office?
So I'm the Title IX coordinator, which means I oversee really everything. So from investigations, outreach and awareness, anything that would fall under Title IX or gender equity as it relates to the university is what I oversee.
Okay. And could you walk me through the process of filling out a Title IX complaint from like the beginning to like what you do, how you do it, who you meet with?
Sure. So reports can come to our office in a variety of ways. Sometimes we get them directly from someone who's been affected by sexual misconduct. Sometimes they come from a professor who knows about an incident. Sometimes it's a roommate or a friend. So report comes to our office from really anywhere. And then the first thing we want to do is reach out to the student who's been affected and see how we might be able to help, because in each situation it's going to be a little bit different. Sometimes we do an investigation. Sometimes the behavior doesn't quite rise to the level of a potential policy violation. But that's the first thing we want to do is, once we're made aware there's something going on, we want to reach out and see what we can do and how we can help. And I'm the one who does that. So I'll reach out and say, hey, we received this report. What can we do to help you? Here are our options as far as, you know, what we can help with. And those options are a full investigation, which is, I'll talk about in a second, kind of what that process looks like. We can also do an informal resolution, which is a little less severe, where there's no discipline or sanctions, but rather just a conversation with kind of both sides to talk about the behavior and how to resolve it. Or we can do nothing. And in some cases, that's because the person isn't willing to give us more information, you know, for whatever reason, which is totally up to them. Or we don't have any reason to believe that the other person is associated with BYU in any way or poses a threat to that person. You know, maybe it's kind of a lower level behavior. Or maybe we just, it doesn't rise to the level of a policy violation. But that's what we're all trying to figure out. So then based off of what that person says, in most cases, what they want us to do is what we'll do. So if they want an investigation, we'll move forward with the investigation. If they don't want us to do anything, we won't do anything. Our goal is to give them back a little bit of the power and control that's been taken away from them as a result of these situations, because that's always, you know, a side effect of any sort of sexual misconduct or sexual harassment is someone feeling like their power and control has been taken away. So we're trying to give that back to them and letting them guide our process and what we do and how we help. In very few instances, we will proceed with an investigation even if they don't want it. And that would be if we do feel like there's an immediate safety threat to them or the campus. So generally, if someone says, I don't want an investigation, I don't want you to do anything, okay, that's fine, we'll honor that request. Because it's up to them. But in very few instances, you know, we look at the totality of the circumstances and everything and figure out if we don't honor this request, are we putting other people then at risk and we might have to move forward. But generally, it's up to the person to tell us what they want us to do. So if they want an investigation, the process is that we then work with them to create what we call an allegation sheet. Of everything that's being alleged that's a policy violation. Now, sometimes there are things, you know, these situations can be really complex and there's a lot going on, and so they'll tell us the whole story, but really what we're looking at is policy violations of the sexual misconduct policy. And so we'll kind of take everything they give us and break it down into what might have violated policy. And so then we take that allegation sheet and we present it to the other party. Now, one thing that I think is really important for students to know is that when we do that, we're not accusing the other party, we're not finding them guilty right away, we're not disciplining them. Our goal is to simply talk to them, explain to them what's been reported, and then get their perspective. I think sometimes people feel that if they've been alleged to have done something and they're getting called into the Title IX office, that they've been found guilty and the honor code's gonna find out and they're gonna be disciplined, when really our goal is to just talk to them in the same way that we've talked to this other person and try to figure out what actually is the situation. So we'll call that other person in, explain to them the report and what's been alleged, and then they have the opportunity to provide their response to the situation and say, you know, there's a lot of different things they say. Either it didn't happen, it didn't happen this way, or, you know, this was my version of the events, this is why, you know, I thought this was okay, or whatever it might be. So then when they provided their response, we kind of go back and forth. We then let the other person see it, see if there's anything they need to respond to, and we kind of go back and forth in the sharing of information until there's no new information, because parties can disagree, and in these cases they disagree forever, you know. But for us, we're really looking at, is there any new information coming forward, or are we just disagreeing? And once there's no new information coming forward, then our investigator will look at potential witnesses, maybe other people who knew about the situation or were involved in this situation. He will take evidence, text messages, social media posts, emails, any sort of evidence. We look at evidence differently than, like, in the criminal justice system. Anything can be evidence for us. So, so in addition to the statements of both parties, we can talk to other people, get other evidence, and then when we feel like we've got everything, but the parties have told us that we have everything, then we make a decision as to whether or not policy was violated. If policy was not violated, then that's the end of the case for us, and we just close it, and that's the end. Now, we can still continue to provide services to one or both parties. You know, if they say, okay, well, you didn't have a violation, but I still need counseling, or I'm still struggling in my classes, you know, we can still continue to work with them and help them, but the case is essentially over. If there is a policy violation, then the way the policy works right now, and it's actually changing in the fairly near future, but the way the policy works right now is we then hand the situation over to the Honor Code, because they're the university's disciplining body for students. And so when we hand the case off, we take out all the names of everyone except for the person who needs to be disciplined. So under our policy and confidentiality, the Title IX office doesn't share information with Honor Code about anyone but the person who, after an investigation, we found violated university policy. And then Honor Code will work with that person to do discipline and all of that. And at the end of that, both parties have the right to appeal. If they're not happy with the decision or how things have gone, they can appeal. We offer that as an option. But generally, that's kind of the process. So report's made, we talk to both parties, talk to witnesses, get evidence, and then decision, and then discipline, and then a potential appeal if there's an issue.
So what about, so I guess this next question is going to be like a fewfold.
Okay.
So it's kind of in conjunction with what your role is with mm-hmm. the Honor Code mm-hmm. office. Because I feel like in some cases you will have a female or whatever that's gets put in a situation where she was sexually harassed mm-hmm. and she won't report that for fear of getting kicked out of BYU.
Mm-hmm.
What is, like, the role in that? Is that accurate? Is that a misconception about how the process works? Because I like how you said you'll remove all the names except for the person mm-hmm. who needs to be disciplined. So in this case, she wouldn't be the one who needs to be disciplined because she
right.
wasn't the one doing the sexual harassment.
Right.
So I guess what is
So when it comes to our relationship with Honor Code, we actually have a really good relationship with Honor Code, which I think is important. You know, I think over the past couple of years, we have further clarified our roles here at the university and separated our offices in such a way that show we have very different roles, but nonetheless we do work together on these cases, especially when it comes to discipline of someone who's violated a policy. And so the relationship we have with them is really good, and in fact we are often getting cases from them. So often students will go and self-report to the Honor Code office, and as the Honor Code office works with that student, they recognize there was an element of coercion or manipulation or force that caused this behavior, which is a violation of policy. And so they'll bring the person down to us and say, hey, Title IX, take a look at this and see, are we looking at a potential Title IX issue, or is it really just Honor Code? And so we have that relationship with them as well, where they are bringing us reports. We don't share information back with them on things like that, but they can share information with us all day long, and they do, in order to ensure students are connected with the best resources and that the best office on campus is addressing it. Because as soon as we start getting into something non-consensual, so someone comes in and says, yeah, this weekend I had sex with my boyfriend and I want to report it, get it off my chest, get in good standing with the Honor Code. And as Honor Code talks to them, the person says, well, he told me he'd stop dating me if I didn't do it. He really forced me to, you know, I didn't want to do it. I told him no, but he pushed it, and I just need to report this. As soon as it becomes that sort of issue, our office is the one to deal with it, and the Honor Code office knows that. And so the relationship we have with them is really important, that they know when a case becomes Title IX to bring it to us, and then they stop their case and bring it to us. So good relationship with them. They've been well trained in recognizing these sorts of things so they can get students here if they need to. When it comes to confidentiality, so the confidentiality is what I was talking about before as far as we don't share any information back with them. And I actually think that's probably the biggest principle that people care about. We often hear about amnesty and how that's really important, which it is. But I think the fact that we're not sharing information in the first place is maybe even more important. So the principle of confidentiality, that all information shared with the Title IX office is kept confidential and not shared with the Honor Code office for anyone but, again, the person who has found to have violated the policy. So confidentiality means we don't share the information in the first place. Now, if the Honor Code somehow becomes aware of other things related, you know, if it was at or near, so say the night the person was assaulted, they were also drinking or doing drugs, or maybe they engaged in some consensual behavior that then turned into non-consensual behavior or something like that. The amnesty policy states that the victim in that situation is not going to be disciplined for anything that happened at or near the time of that incident. And so if Honor Code somehow finds out, so say the person goes in to be disciplined and they say, well, this person was also drinking that night and, you know, she needs to be disciplined too, using gender normative terms, the Honor Code, that's when amnesty kicks in, because for anything at or near the time of the incident of sexual misconduct, amnesty applies and someone won't be disciplined in any way for anything, any other Honor Code violations there might have been. Now, so confidentiality, amnesty, the third principle as outlined in our policy is what's called leniency. So say there's more to the situation. So maybe a couple has been having a long-standing consensual sexual relationship that falls outside of Honor Code and the behavior that would be allowed under the Honor Code. And then at one night it becomes non-consensual or violent or whatever, and then it makes it to our office. So where there's kind of all this behavior that's not really related to the incident of sexual misconduct, didn't happen at or near the incident of sexual misconduct, that's when the leniency principle comes into play. So basically that's us working with the Honor Code to say, okay, we understand that, you know, there was some behavior that wasn't in line with the Honor Code, but we need to help this student. We need to look at the bigger picture. And in most cases, allowing that student to stay in school, maybe work with a counselor, you know, figure some of these issues out is the best thing to do, as opposed to disciplining them, kicking them out of school, and, you know, kind of saying good luck. Like, that's probably one of the worst things we can do for victims. And so for us, we will work with the Honor Code to say, okay, amnesty might apply to this one night when all of this happened, but leniency would apply to maybe the 6 months before that they were engaging in a relationship that they shouldn't have been. Let's work with the student and help her work through, you know, some of those behaviors while allowing her to stay in school, continue to, you know, work towards graduation and all of that. So those are the three key principles: is confidentiality, amnesty, and leniency. And that's what we work with the Honor Code on, figuring out kind of which one applies at which point. Our ultimate goal is not to kick people out of school, whether it's a victim who's also violated the Honor Code or someone who's found to have violated a policy. You know, I think we often hear that if someone's done something bad, they should get kicked out of school. If they've violated the sexual misconduct policy, they should be kicked out of school. But for us, even with the people who are perpetrating these things, we feel like we can help and we can do more with them than just kick them out of school. Once we've kicked them out of school, we've made them someone else's problem and we've done nothing. So in the most serious cases, of course, that's what we're gonna do. We're not gonna leave someone on campus who's a threat or who's violated policy in the most egregious ways. But if we've got a situation where we've determined it's, you know, a probation or a suspension or something like that, then maybe we can help that person understand the impact of their actions and how doing these is wrong, and help them work through it in a way that's productive. And so, you know, even people who violate policy, our goal is not to just kick them out of school. We want to be able to help them really understand, because I think, you know, in doing this work of sexual violence prevention, we often talk about like intervention and prevention. And intervention, the analogy we use is like the fence at the top of the hill or the ambulance at the bottom, right? And we want to be both. We want to be the ambulance that can intervene if something happens, but we also want to be the fence at the top that keeps people from falling over in the first place. And when it comes to prevention, I think one of the best things we can do is work with perpetrators and help them understand so it doesn't happen again to future victims. So kicking people out of school is not our goal, whether it's someone who's violated the Honor Code, and is a victim, or someone who's violated the honor code and is a perpetrator. So that's kind of our goal, is really helping our students understand the impact of their actions and how to improve them for the future while allowing them to stay in school, because that's when we can really help. We don't want to just make it someone else's problem and get rid of it, unless that person is such a serious offender that there's nothing we feel we can do, in which case we will kick them out of school, and we have done that. So So the relationship with Honor Code, we work with them quite often, both on the front end with them bringing us report, and then on the back end with, okay, this person needs to be disciplined, or this victim has engaged in these behaviors, but here's where we need to offer amnesty and leniency to allow them to stay in school. So
how would you say BYU's Title IX office differs from other universities? Would it just be this relationship with the Honor Code, since that's what BYU has? Or?
So what's interesting about our relationship with the Honor Code and the fact that we have an Honor Code is in the majority of situations at other schools that I know about, their conduct office, which is kind of the equivalent of the Honor Code office, is involved in handling their cases also in the same way that our Honor Code handles our cases. BYU is not unique in that. I think people think that because we have this Honor Code office, that we have a different situation here at BYU, and we really don't. In most schools, there's a Title IX officer or a Title IX coordinator or someone who does the Title IX piece, but then the conduct office, because nearly all schools have some form of student code of conduct, and they have a conduct office to oversee it, they work with Title IX in the same way that we work with Honor Code office. Now, our level of student conduct is obviously what's different, right? Like, we don't allow even consensual behavior before marriage and drinking and things like that. So our code of conduct is different, but the interaction between the two offices is not uncommon. And so that's where it's been really interesting for me, is all this issue was kind of blowing up, and as I was learning about other schools and trying to figure out, are we doing something wrong and how do we fix this? Recognizing that most schools are functioning in the same way, where Title IX office works with the conduct office on these cases and figures out the best way to handle them. So I do think that because of the level of our conduct, our student code of conduct and the honor code, it's looked at differently, because students can get in trouble for things that they wouldn't get in trouble for at other schools. And that's really the unique difference. But as far as structurally how things are set up, it's not different really than any other university. It's more just our connection with them in addressing behaviors that are against the code of conduct that other universities wouldn't really have to look at. Mm-hmm. So
So what are some pieces of advice that you would give to BYU students in dealing with sexual assault cases, whether it's them who was involved or a friend? Mm-hmm. What kind of advice would you give them?
So I think the biggest piece of advice I would give them is know what resources are available and know where to get help. The Title IX office, we have a very specific role on campus. We oversee this for the whole university, which means we usually should have a pretty good pulse on, do we have serial offenders? Are there a bigger threat? Do we have bigger issues going on? Because we're kind of the big umbrella that oversees everything. There's a lot of offices that are getting different pieces of this, but our office theoretically should be the one that kind of oversees everything, can manage it at a university level. And then our office can help specifically with the student's university experience. And so we can provide letters to professors if someone's struggling in class as a result of either being a victim or being involved in an investigation. We can provide letters to professors. We can work with on-campus employment to change work schedules. We can work with housing. We can work with the registrar's office if someone needs a petition to withdraw from a class. There is so much that we can do to help a student specific to their campus experience to allow them to continue in school and be successful students. Because one thing we found is when students face these difficult situations, the first inclination is kind of retreat, withdraw from school, and try to figure it out, when really allowing them to continue in kind of that stability of classes and school and in some sense of normalcy is really important. So we want to help whatever we can do to make that happen. So that's our role at the university. Now, we have other people like the victim advocate. Fantastic. She's a confidential source. She doesn't report to us. She can get students connected with counseling. She can accompany them to appointments. She can provide them with community resources. Mm-hmm. So she has a different role, but a no less important role. And so we want students to know they can also go to her. They can come to us if they need the help that we can provide. They can go to her if they need the help she can provide. There's also counseling center, also confidential, if a student just needs to talk through things and work with a therapist, you know, either in the short or long term to work through these issues. They're a great resource. They also don't report to us. They're confidential. But that's also a great place if a student is struggling with these sorts of things or if someone they know is. They're a great place to go. There's Women's Services. There's a Student Health Center. There's the Accessibility Center. There's all these great places on campus. As a Title IX office, we're not territorial over this. We're not like, everyone should come to us and everyone needs to report to us. Our thought is everyone needs to get help if they're facing this situation. So wherever they feel most comfortable, I think the most important thing is knowing what all those resources are, what they can provide, and how they can help so you can figure out, okay, for my healing and getting through the situation, this is the resource that's going to be best for me, or this is the resource that's going to be best for you. Or maybe it's a combination of all of us. We often all work together. Someone goes to the victim advocate and they come to us and they go to the accessibility center and they go to counseling. But that's the biggest thing, is knowing that there are people here on campus that want to provide these resources and want to provide this help, and then knowing what each can do and figuring out where the best place is to get help. So whether it's for someone who's been affected or someone who someone knows that has been affected by this, or even someone who's involved in an investigation, because we recognize that being accused of something can also be very traumatic and scary. And so we have resources on campus for, you know, people who have been accused to have violated policy, including an advisor they can speak with confidentially. And, you know, they can also go to counseling and we can help them as well. So really just looking at the whole picture and wanting to help in the best way possible and stop these behaviors from happening on campus, whether they're low level and we can stop them with a conversation with both parties, or they're a little bit bigger and we need to do an investigation and determine if someone needs to be, you know, off our campus. But our goal is really to help, and I think the first way that we can help is by educating people on the importance of these issues and what resources are available.
Mm-hmm. My last question for you is, how have you enjoyed working in this role? What has been your experience?
So enjoyed is an interesting word. I would say that I do enjoy this role. It's hard. I think that anyone doing work like this, it's really challenging, because at the end of the day, no matter what we're able to do, what help we're able to provide, we can't take away experiences that people have. And we can't remove those situations and those feelings and that trauma from someone's life. And so it can be really challenging to feel like no matter how much you do, it's just never quite enough, because you can never take that away. But the reason I come back and do it every day is because in those situations, if you're able to provide a little bit of support, a little bit of help to help that person get through it and feel that they were supported and respected and cared for and listened to, then it helps them get on that path to healing. We can't control people's behaviors and people's actions, but we can control the way the university responds to these situations, and the compassion, the level of compassion through which we do. And I think that's one thing that the university's done a really good job at, from President Worthen all the way down. I think it's clear that this issue is important to the university, and we want to help. We want to help end this behavior on our campus. Of all campuses, BYU shouldn't have these behaviors occurring. But we want to stop the behavior, and we want to help those who've been affected by the behavior. And in most cases, we have a lot of situations where the student, maybe it's our student who's been a victim of one of these situations, and then the other person doesn't have anything to do with our campus. I think generally we have a very good student body, and we have people who are trying to do the right things. A lot of the perpetrators we see have nothing to do with BYU, and so that's great. But in looking at our campus, it's how can we provide a compassionate response to everyone involved in our process, whether they've been a victim or whether they've been accused? How can we make everyone feel listened to and heard about? And at the end of the day, recognizing that if we're doing that, then this job is really rewarding. It can be hard. We have days when we've made no one happy, you know, and in most cases, it seems like there's going to be kind of a winner and a loser, because in every case, we're making a decision as to, you know, which side of the story, you know, we feel is more plausible. And so inevitably someone's going to be unhappy with us. But I think one thing that we feel is that if we're able to provide that compassionate support and respect and letting people know they've been heard, again, whichever side of the story they're on, then that's what makes it meaningful for us. And then knowing that if we can get them on that path of healing, maybe it's not today that they realize, you know, that things will get better, but maybe in a year, you know, they'll see how what little teeny bit of help we provided was beneficial. So I like this work. I don't know if enjoy or like is the right word, but I'm grateful that the university gives me this opportunity to be able to reach out and help. I have had my own experiences with these situations, and I know there were a lot of people who reached out to and helped me, and it's because of people in positions like this that probably that I'm even here. And so I'm grateful to be able to turn around and give back in a way that hopefully helps other people, and then they can turn around and give back when they've healed, and you know, we can really impact this issue in positive ways.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah.
I do have a final request.
Sure.
Would it be okay if I take a picture of you for the story?
Oh my heavens, like what kind of picture?
Just like not like a posed
like
one.
A candid shot,
yeah, like
of
a
some
candid
sort.
Shot of you just
even just like